I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is slowly returning to Washington after a weekend in which talk shows focused on Majority Leader Harry Reid's comment that then-candidate Barack Obama had light skin and a lack of Negro dialect. And Budget Director Peter Orszag's love life was also under the radar, including an out-of-wedlock child. Democrats say they want to get down to the business of finishing health care reform in order to tackle jobs and financial reform before next year's midterm elections. They may just do that. Congressional Quarterly reports today that Obama set a new record last year for getting his way with Congress. He won 96.7% of the votes in which he'd clearly staked a position. But Republicans want to capitalize on public dissatisfaction with health care reform, not to mention Harry Reid's comments and Peter Orszag's dating life. Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, joins us to raise the curtain on the week ahead. Gail, what do you think? The Democrats have so much on their agenda. And we haven't even gotten to cap and trade and the economic stimulus package. But suddenly we have all these little stories over the weekend, but also the very big story of the recent terror attacks. Does this derail the Democratic agenda?
This is an agenda that is going on its own steam at this point. This president has taken on so many large, significant issues all at once that even if he can just get one or two of them in this year, it is historic.
Well, let's go to health care, which is the one he very much wants to get out of the way first, or off the to-do list. He's meeting with labor leaders this afternoon to try to forge a compromise, to get the labor leaders on board with the idea of taxing the so-called Cadillac or high-end health insurance plans. Those that have them say they aren't that high-end, but as many as a quarter of union members have them. Does reform hinge on this?
It hinges on the spending mechanism for sure. The House is very, very concerned about this. Their speaker got together a mass conference call last week to just focus on especially this question of this high-cost plan, because it's such a key issue for labor and for states with high premiums, which tend to be blue states.
Yeah.
So her members are going to take this on the chin. On the other hand, the Senate is not eager to pick up the House mechanism, which is taxing especially highly people earning more than $500,000. So whatever this grand bargain that comes out of the House-Senate talks, if it doesn't solve the funding, it hasn't solved anything. So this is a very important issue.
Well, what about the way the Obama administration has gone about crafting legislation? John McCain and others really hammering away at what they call a lack of promised transparency. Even Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska has said that his special deal, we remember this is the one in which the government would pick up his state's tab for expanding Medicaid. Nelson now says this should be extended to other states. It's not fair. But are those backroom deals going to backfire?
These backroom deals are more transparent than I think any in congressional history. What happened with Ben Nelson was astonishing. The details of that deal were known within minutes of their being achieved, because there's so much. You've got the news media on the Hill, you've got the blogs picking up things, you've got cameras following who's going into meetings with whom, what they're asking, you've got leaks all over the place. Ben Nelson goes home to Nebraska, where he had been very popular, and finds an uprising. You know, people are outraged at what it appears to be a special deal that makes sure that Nebraskans will never have to pay an increase in Medicare costs. Other states will, and there's an outrage. It was so bad that he had to go on television. He's not even up for re-election until 2012 to explain this decision, and now he's repudiated it, which I think is the secret of this whole enterprise. This is a very high-profile procedure, including these back deals, and if the public responds to them, as they did in Nebraska, they die.
Well, I just want to make sure we've touched on financial reform. The House has passed its bill creating a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. The Senate doesn't support that. And then we also have former California Treasurer Phil Angelides kicking off the first of his federal commission hearings to look into what caused the financial collapse. It's being likened to the Pecora Commission of the 30s, which raked bankers over the coals, led to the New Deal. So what's the thinking about how much the Obama administration is going to be able to do when it comes to financial reform?
I think there's a lot of pressure to do something on financial reform, especially from the public. The White House now and Congress have got to be thinking about this 2010 elections. What is going to be top of mind for voters? There is no question it is jobs, jobs, and more jobs. And that's why there's so much pressure to get through health care and get back to jobs quickly. But there's also a tremendous amount of resentment about the big bonuses, bonus season.
Which is here.
And that's what the Angelides Commission is going to get at on Wednesday when they summon the heads of the big banks. Now, that'll be good theater. But whether it will be good legislation, I think, is a huge question. The big difference between the PCORA Commission and the Angelides Commission is that Congress waited for the PCORA Commission before they legislated. They're flying ahead with regulation without waiting to hear what the commission has to say. Very bad sign.
Cale Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, sort of setting the table for the week ahead for us. And, boy, it's a very big crowd at that table. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We want to turn to North Korea for a few minutes today. North Korea said today that it would return to talks on nuclear disarmament in exchange for a peace treaty and an end to U.S. sanctions. Such a treaty would formally end the Korean War, which, of course, was fought between the North and the South, two countries created after World War II when Korea was divided. In the decades after what was a simple ceasefire rather than a formal peace treaty, and under the dictatorship of Kim Il-sung, North Korea's economy slowly ground to a halt as its backers, the Soviet Union and East Germany, fell. Finally, in the 1990s, a famine that's still difficult to hear about.
People did not go passively to their deaths. When the public distribution system was cut off, they devised traps out of buckets and string to catch small animals in the field. They stripped the sweet inner bark of pine trees to grind into a fine powder that could be used in place of flour. They picked kernels of undigested corn out of the excrement of farm animals. Shipyard workers developed a technique by which they scraped the bottoms of the cargo holds where food had been stored, then spread the foul-smelling gunk on the pavement to dry so that they could collect from it tiny grains of uncooked rice and other edibles.
Journalist Barbara Demick. In her new book, we learn North Koreans still supplement diets with picked grass and weeds. She also tells us horrendous stories of orphan children called wandering swallows, drowning a friendly dog in a bucket to have something to eat. Neighborhoods with elected leaders who assign chores and report suspicious activity. Her book is Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. And Barbara Demick joins us from NPR's New York Bureau. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Boy, what stories. It reads, you know, sort of like science fiction. Just give us a little bit of a thumbnail. How did Kim Il-sung, how did he get the people to abide by rules like absolutely no family pictures anywhere on the wall, just a picture of him and then later his son? And the pictures came with a white cloth that could only be used for keeping the pictures clean. And there's an inspector who comes once a month to make sure you're cleaning the picture. I mean, how do you get people to abide by that?
You start brainwashing them from early childhood. The song, We Have Nothing to Envy in This World, from which I take the title of the book, is a very popular children's song. And in fact, many kindergartens have this slogan on the outside. And people are told that they live in the best country in the world, they have nothing to envy, that they're leaders are the equivalent of God. They've borrowed, you know, many of the images from Christianity. North Koreans are told that when Kim Jong-il, the present leader, was born, there was a bright star in the sky, a double rainbow. So this is the only voice you heard because their television stations are all affixed to a single government dial, and they don't hear any other viewpoints.
Well, and you do hear from, as you said, these six defectors who, it's like they were in a Truman world, like Jim Carrey in the film. You know, once they're out of the bubble, they go, oh, wow, look at that. But tell us more about what they said while they were in the bubble. You have, for instance, Mrs. Song. She worked in a factory, and her life just starts to unravel as North Korea starts to unravel with the fall of East Germany and then the Soviet Union, both of whom had helped prop up North Korea.
Mrs. Song is the person who I call the true believer. She came of age in the 1950s, 1960s, when North Korea was considered to be somewhat more prosperous than South Korea. And she was one of the ones who, you know, very joyfully dusted the portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. She was the head of this people's group, the Imanbun, that had to spy on the neighbors. And, you know, she was so inculcated in these myths of North Korea that even after her family members started to die of starvation, first her mother-in-law, then her husband, then her only son, she wasn't able to blame the government. She felt it had to be her fault. And, you know, during the famine, the North Korean regime stepped up its propaganda. People were told that the reason there was no food was that the U.S. had a blockade. This was completely untrue. In fact, at a time, the U.S. was the largest food donor to North Korea.
And what was happening was that the military, in part, was stealing the donated food and, you know, selling on the black market, so it wasn't getting to people.
Yes, in part. I mean, there also, you know, there was no food because the system had failed, the economy had failed, the regime's ideology was completely bankrupt, as were the coffers. They had no money.
It's so, you paint a picture through the stories of these defectors of a country almost grinding to a halt. As you write, North Korea just sort of fades to black. You can't even see it on satellite images because when the Soviet Union collapses, there goes the cheap fuel. There goes the electricity. People start stealing copper off the electrical wires. So there's literally no light in North Korea at night.
That's right. North Koreans often tell me about, you know, how you could walk down the street and you would maybe only know somebody was there because you could see the tip of their cigarette glowing. You could walk through the city and you'd feel like you were in the desert because the buildings would be swallowed up by the dark.
Can you just tell us some of the things that different people told you that they just accepted as the limbo bar lowers for them? They just all accept it. Just tell us some of the stories.
Well, you know, each and every one of these people can remember the first time they saw a dead body.
Yeah.
Death was just, you know, everywhere. They saw dead bodies by the side of the road. In the train station, people rode in train cars and would find that the person sitting in their compartment was dead. I was very moved by this kindergarten teacher whose pupils begin to die of starvation. And, you know, one by one, these 5 and 6 year olds, you know, they get skinny, their hair turns brittle and yellowish, their eyes are sunken, they put their heads on their desk, they fall asleep in class. And, you know, as she said, if there was just one of them, you know, the teachers would go to the family's house and try to help them. But there were so many that they steeled themselves to ignore it. And this person today is racked by terrible guilt, but she learned not to really care when she saw a starving child. She learned not to want to share her own food, and that was a survival instinct.
Well, and that teacher, Miran, does survive and defects. How does that happen? When we come back, we'll ask journalist Barbara Demick. Her book is Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. We'll have much more with her in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Later today, we'll meet that Christian counselor that many blame for that proposed anti-gay law in Uganda. But right now, we're getting incredible insight into a secretive and backward North Korea from journalist Barbara Demick, who covered that country for the LA Times and has now profiled 6 defectors, including a factory worker and government loyalist named Mrs. Song, and the student Jung Sang, who secretly met with his girlfriend Miran for 13 years, during which time they barely kissed. He had no idea that women menstruated. Barbara Demick's new book is Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. And Barbara, you write that by 2001, an estimated 100,000 North Koreans had left for China. Some of them ended up in South Korea. But for each of the defectors you spoke with, something happened. They finally saw the government was lying to them. A light bulb goes off. Give some examples.
There was one North Korean who told me he saw a propaganda photo of South Korean striking workers, and I think this was in the newspaper, and it was supposed to show how oppressed the workers were in South Korea, and it showed a guy with his fist up. But what this North Korean saw was he saw that this oppressed South Korean worker had a jacket with a zipper, which was a great luxury at that time, that in a pocket he had a ballpoint pen, you know, unimaginable for anybody but the richest North Korean, and also that the South Korean worker was protesting. And this man was completely swayed. Another North Korean I met worked for the fishing ministry. And one day they confiscated a Chinese fishing boat that was in illegal waters. And on that boat was a radio. They turned on the radio and they picked up a broadcast from South Korea of a radio comedy. There were two young women who were fighting about a parking space. And the man was completely confused. He had never heard of anybody who owned their own car.
Yeah.
And a few years later, he defected.
I love the story you tell about Jun Sang. Again, this is the student who loved to read and started picking up books like Dale Carnegie's books. And he can't believe that Dale Carnegie is talking about learn to love, respect, and enjoy other people. What? He thought capitalists could never do anything like that. But he also got a television set, and he rigged it up so that he could watch it without the Electric Wave Inspection Bureau police figuring out that he was seeing something from outside the state-run North Korean television. And I love the scene where he first hears Kim Jong-il.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking.
Because Kim Jong-il's voice is not broadcast inside North Korea. That's one of the ways that you keep the sense of this man as God. They had never heard Kim Jong-il's voice, and the occasion was the South Korean president, Kim Dae-jung, had come to Pyongyang, and Kim Jong-il was saying, you know, here are our monuments and here are our museums. He was just an ordinary person, and it's my God, he was human.
But then for your defectors becomes another hard time. Once the light bulb goes off, they can't tell anyone.
That's right. Jun Sang realizes that he doesn't believe anymore, but he can't tell the person he's closest to, Miran, his girlfriend, and really his best friend. It's too risky. It would endanger her life, her safety. And he doesn't tell her. And at the same time, she doesn't tell him that she's also thinking about defecting from North Korea.
In fact, she leaves first. And it's so sad because you realize if they'd spoken, they might have left together and had a life together. And just as they leave, it's shockingly easy. They find that there are people willing to guide them to a spot where they can walk into China. So, Barbara Demick, what do you take from this story of North Korea? If more people knew, would more people leave? What's your sense of that?
I think a lot of people do know. And a lot of people do leave, but once they get to China, the Chinese will hunt them down, and then they're in more trouble than they were to begin with.
Well, that's one downside, but also their lives are in such limbo. I mean, it's not just that they, you know, Mrs. Song arrives in South Korea in the bathroom in the airport. She doesn't know how to use the flush, but they really are in just a sort of limbo.
That's right. And, you know, there are many North Korean defectors have told me that they regretted leaving. You know, these people, too, they love their country. They have their criticism with the leadership. But North Korea is their home. And, you know, one thing that happens is, and this especially happened to the defectors who left in the 90s, when they left, their relatives left behind were punished. So I tell you, there are many North Koreans, and I've met some of them, who still live in North Korea, and they know. They know their regime is bankrupt. They know life is better on the outside. But they go back for their families, and, you know, they also know that it's not going to be easy for them once they leave.
Do you get any sense of some kind of ice cracking here, any sense of that number of people in North Korea in our lifetime fomenting some kind of revolution from within?
I've got to be honest. I think most people don't have much hope of changing the system. I could imagine some kind of coup d'etat happening among the elite, especially if there's a crisis over the succession. Kim Jong-il, the current leader, is in his 60s. He's in poor health. And he's trying to anoint his youngest son, who's still in his 20s, as the successor. And I certainly could imagine some sort of power struggle that would result in the collapse of the regime. I don't see any kind of rebellion starting up in the provinces among the regular people. But I will say that they are much quicker to resist than they used to be. I mean, for example, the North Korean government has really tried to close the markets where people, mainly women, have been, you know, making money the last few years. And I know that, you know, some of these older women who work at the markets have protested when they've tried to ban soybeans from the market or ban rice. And that's met with, you know, certainly resistance, and people are much quicker to say no than they were in the past.
That's Barbara Demick, a longtime reporter for the Los Angeles Times in North and South Korea. Her new book, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea, tells the stories of six North Korean defectors. It's fascinating. Barbara, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Okay. Tomorrow on Here and Now, swine flu vaccinations are available. Are people getting them? That's tomorrow. The latest news is next, Here and Now. It's official. NBC is pulling the plug on Jay Leno's 10 p.m. primetime program after 4 months. His last show will be on February 11th. After that, the network wants Leno to move back to 11:35 Eastern Time, a spot now occupied by Conan O'Brien. Well, at least both comedians have been getting great material out of the rumors leading up to the announcement. Here's Conan O'Brien.
I'm pregnant with Jay's baby. Jay's pregnant with my baby. We're both pregnant with Tiger Woods' babies. NBC is going to throw me and Jay in a pit with sharpened sticks. The one who crawls out alive gets to leave NBC.
Ha, ha, ha. But the question, of course, will someone be leaving NBC? Joining us from the late-night mosh pit, Washington Post-style reporter Paul Fahey. Paul, serious negotiations are going on today. What are they talking about that you know?
They're talking about whether Conan O'Brien stays or whether Conan O'Brien goes, and if he stays, where he goes within NBC. The proposal on the table is that he would move his show from 11:35 to 12:05 behind Jay Leno in that late-night slot. He'd take the Tonight Show name with him to that slot.
Yeah, but, you know, everybody tends to think of the Tonight Show as the thing that comes after your local news, which was part of the problem. The local affiliates were the ones who forced this.
That's exactly right. Their late local news was seriously hurt by, you know, Jay's lead-in being so weak.
We understand WBAL-TV in Baltimore lost more than half of its 11 o'clock news lead-in.
That's right. That was the extreme outer edge of the carnage. But on average, the stations were losing 25%, 30%, 40% of their 11 p.m. news. And for local stations, local news is where all the money is. And during a recession, they can't afford to have those kind of ratings.
Well, you say the question is whether or not Conan O'Brien will stay in what he sees as a perhaps a demotion. But Jay Leno is the one who made a joke about moving around. Here he is with Kevin Eubanks, of course, his band leader.
So far, nobody said anything to me. But, Kev, you know, if we did get canceled, give us time to maybe do some traveling.
That would be wonderful, man.
In fact, I understand Fox is beautiful this time.
It really is.
So Jay Leno making jokes about going to Fox. You say, you know, Conan O'Brien maybe making noises about leaving. And it's not the first time he might do that.
That's right. And this was all set in motion about 5 years ago when Conan was threatening to leave to go to another network. NBC wanted to prevent that. It wanted to keep Jay Leno, so it arranged this 10 p.m. for Jay and Tonight Show for Conan. Here it is now 5 years later, and it's not working.
Well, it's not the first time. It's been like checkers for decades in late night. David Letterman moved to CBS from NBC, hurt feelings there when Jay Leno got the Tonight Show slot. But what do you think all of this says about the health of the networks right now?
It says particularly bad things about the health of NBC, but the networks in general are in a real death throw at this point. Some people think they've only got a few years left to live.
Really? I'm just going to jump in there for a second because we heard some analysis over the week, and then in fact this shows that NBC had a little more fuel in it than people thought because the audience wanted to see their NBC drama at 10 o'clock.
That's true, but, you know, NBC's rationale for putting Jay Leno on at 10 o'clock underlies this whole thing, which is dramas are really expensive. Yeah. There isn't enough advertising to really support them. There isn't enough audience around because there's so much competition. The Internet has exacerbated this, and it's only going to get worse.
Well, and the irony is that it comes at a time when NBC is rich in talent. Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, and Jimmy Fallon. What about him? He's been joking that, you know, you might see him when you get up in the morning. He'll be pushed back so far.
Well, you know, Jimmy's been on the air for about 6 or 7 months, so it's not like he has a real long track record. But, yeah, he gets bumped back if Conan stays. And Carson Daly, who's on in the late, late, late slot, he ends up being bumped altogether because by the time Carson's show would come on, NBC no longer controls the time slot, the affiliates do. So, you know, it's musical chairs, I guess, and someone's going to lose their chair here.
Or Carson Daly becomes your morning weatherman.
Yeah.
Paul Farhi, a Washington Post-style reporter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, a Christian counselor says he never intended for Ugandans to draft a law to imprison homosexuals. But does his campaign to help parents turn their children from their homosexuality feed into a hatred of gay people? We'll talk to Don Schmierer in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Gays and lesbians in Uganda say the climate of intolerance has skyrocketed in the months since three American evangelical Christians came to their country for a conference on the dangers of the gay agenda. A month after that meeting, Uganda proposed the Anti-Homosexuality Bill of 2009, which, among other things, calls for the death penalty for some types of homosexual behavior and life imprisonment for practically all. The Americans at the conference were Caleb Brundage, who describes himself as formally gay. Scott Lively of Defend the Family. He claims 20 years of fighting what he calls the homosexual movement. And Don Schmierer, who, when he went to Uganda, was a member of the board of Exodus International, an organization devoted to helping gays leave homosexuality to, as they put it, gain freedom through Jesus Christ. Don is an author whose books include An Ounce of Prevention, Preventing the Homosexual Condition in Today's Youth. We spoke with him last week and asked for his initial response to Uganda's call for gays and lesbians to be imprisoned, even killed.
It's horrible. I mean, my first reaction when I learned about it was, I can't believe anybody's doing that type of thing. Not today. I mean, good night.
You signed a letter to Ugandan President Museveni. What did you say?
He said we thought it was a horrible law. They shouldn't do it.
An excerpt from the letter, "While God does not condone homosexual behavior, the deprivation of life is not the appropriate response." So you say you were horrified, but you know your critics would say, what would you expect? Let's listen to a little bit of a portion of one of the lectures at that conference. This is Scott Lively.
If you actually accept the term sexual orientation for what it really means, and you say that you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, then that would mean that you can't discriminate on the basis of pedophilia. It means you can't stop someone from molesting children, or that you can't stop them from having sex with animals.
Don Schmierer, it's a small step from that statement to Ugandans equating homosexuality between consenting adults with pedophilia, with children. And here's Scott Lively conflating that even more, but also saying that homosexuality is something that is acquired.
If it can be acquired, shouldn't we be doing everything in our power to protect people from acquiring it? Shouldn't we lean to the side of protecting the children?
Let me clear up a couple things.
Please.
Number one, when I agreed to come there, I was to be the only speaker and to be speaking on healthy parenting. When I got there, I found out that how they advertised me, which was a shock to me.
How did they advertise you?
Well, they advertised me as speaking... what was the comment that you used that he said is...
Against the gay agenda?
Yeah, against the gay agenda, yeah. I mean, that's not what I'm talking about.
Well, your critics, like blogger James Withers, say that is what you're talking about. He writes, your whole movement is based on painting gays and lesbians as monsters. So, Don Schmierer, you tell us, what do you counsel parents?
I teach parents how to help connect with their kids when there's a difference. Like one of the first things I teach people, and I say this very sincerely, some of the nicest people I've ever met on the face of the earth are gay people. And I mean it. But one of the things that I teach right off front, the first thing we talk about is listening, how to listen to each other. The second thing that I try to teach them is to how to affirm them for who they are.
So do you teach parents to affirm their children if their children are gay?
No, I didn't say that.
Okay. So what would you tell a parent to do if their child was gay?
I would. One thing that really pushes them that way, because they feel a disconnect with a same-sex parent. And I'm really going after the fathers to try to be fathers and to get involved with their children.
So you believe that boys, I mean, it sounds like you're talking about boys, might turn to homosexuality because they don't get the love they need from their father?
I think they're pushed in that direction because they're looking for affirmation, they're looking for acceptance.
So it sounds as if you help parents try to steer their children away from homosexuality, which you feel is something that young people get pushed to if their parents aren't giving them enough love. But the latest resolution from the American Psychological Association says that mental health professionals should not tell clients they can change their sexual orientation, and that further, it might even be damaging, harmful to young people in particular, that homosexuality in large part is not something you turn to, it's something you are.
Well, they have their opinion on that, don't they?
Yes. So I'm just asking you, does it give you pause at all? It sounds like it doesn't.
No, because I'm not just speaking about gay things. I'm talking about just family life, period.
It's just so hard for some people to grasp, you know, why, if you believe that Christ is love, why not teach a parent to love the child that is showing signs of being homosexual? Why not teach love and acceptance?
Yeah, when you understand at the root they feel a rejection from that same parent, we have to get back and deal with that thing first. Not only the homosexual person or person that goes into homosexuality, but a person that goes into any other addictive behavior. There's some hurt that they felt while being raised. And if I can help a parent or a society understand that both affirmation and listening and loving people unconditionally, that's going to help them. It's going to help everybody.
I guess, and just one last time, and we're starting to chase our individual tails here. You seem to equate it with drugs and other problems and make it the parents' fault. There are families where there are healthy, happy, homosexual young people.
I've not run into a healthy home, healthy family. You know, I've had people tell me this, and yet when I got acquainted with them, I found other things that were amiss, like they never measured up to the parents. And I share with people one of the other opening statements I make, I say, you can do everything right and everything can turn out wrong.
What do you say to people who say there's not that much difference between Scott Lively, who speaks almost violently about gays, and you who teach that you can change a child who's going to be gay? They feel it all leads to the same ending, which is, you know, somehow people hating or trying to change and making the other a gay person.
I'm sorry, but they have not heard me speak.
Do you feel at all responsible for the alleged uptick in violence against gays?
No, I'm sorry. I mean, I got tied into something that I walked into it, and I didn't know what I was walking into.
I'm presuming you are praying, or maybe, I don't know, are you praying that law does not pass?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that should not. That's horrible. It's an absolutely horrible law.
Don, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back. When I say accordion, you may think polka or Astro Piazzolla tango, but jazz? That's Rhode Island native Corey Pesaturo's take on the Thelonious Monk classic, Well, You Needn't. And yes, that is an accordion, not just any accordion. It's a Roland digital accordion, which adds the computer technology of the synthesizer to the bellows and keyboard of traditional accordion. And it's not just any accordion player. This fall, Corey Pesaturo won the World Digital Accordion Championship. He's 23. He's been playing professionally since he was 11. He trained at the New England Conservatory of Music here in Boston. He's released two CDs and played at the White House, but he was also laughed off the show America's Got Talent by panelist David Hasselhoff, who pretty much said, "We just don't like accordions." Well, you should never mock a squeeze box player, especially the one sitting across from me. As the Boston Globe says, if anyone can confer sex appeal on the accordion, it's him. Corey Pesaturo, welcome.
Very glad to be here.
Let's give just a taste. People feel that they might know, you know, the polka from Lawrence Welk or Piazzolla's wonderful tangos or, you know, some other accordion sounds. Could you just go through some of the different classical sounds, and then we'll get more even of the sounds that you get beyond the well-known sounds. Just go through some sounds for us.
All right, so we'll start with a French thing.
Okay.
A little French thing.
Gorgeous.
Now we'll go to a polka thing.
And what are you doing there? You're hitting some buttons there.
Yeah, just going through different, there's many, many different sets and patches that you have on. And then you can make your own, of course.
Yeah, okay.
Everybody roll the bell. Okay.
Well, now give me a sound that's completely unique to this new digital accordion, something that doesn't...
All right. What I can... This is nice because I'll do... It's kind of an Italian piece, many people know, but with all the different switches on here,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to sound like a normal accordion.
Can you do, oh, there go the bellows.
Oh.
Can you do, like, a rock sound on this since it's a synthesizer?
Yeah.
So that's like a guitar jam. What do purists say about this?
This is the problem, actually. But we're almost done the mini war we've kind of had because, you know, the traditional accordion players and the purists, you know, have said, oh, God, this is not an accordion, this is not an accordion. But what I've tried to tell all of them is look, the accordion is not going to be saved in its acoustic form. It's just not going to happen. It's going to continue to die. This can save it. By going throughout the world with this and re-energizing the image of the accordion and renewing it, then once it's cool and hip again, we can say, oh, by the way, this is the real accordion, and people will accept it. Where right now, if you bring out the acoustic accordion, they go, oh, the accordion.
And also, you know, it reminds me, it's of course like when Dylan, you know, went electric, you know, mm-hmm. everyone went nuts, but... What do you think about Myron Florin, the Lawrence Welk accordionist, or Frank Yankovic, the polka king who won all those Grammys? Did the traditionalist inform you?
Well, I mean, I certainly love Myron Florin and all those guys. I know a lot of accordionists will tell you that they kind of ruined the image of the accordion, but, you know, it was just happened that way. They're certainly great accordion players.
And what makes a great accordion player? Is it speed? We watched your fingers just fly over the keys.
I'm more known, yes, for speed, but I mean, I actually like to play very slow, meaningful music in many ways more than the speed.
Let's hear a little of that sound. This is Laura from your CD Crosswinds with George Garzon on sax.
What makes a great accordion player is, without question, it's the bellows. You have to have good bellows control because so many people pick up the accordion. Oh, there's my grandma's accordion. They go to play it. And the thing is, they know the piano. So they go, oh, I can play accordion. I'll figure out the bass. And they think they can play. And they're not realizing the entire instrument is the bellows because this is just a piano and this is another system.
Let's explain that. When you say this is just a piano, you mean the keyboard. And then you've got a synthesizer system on it. So there's all sorts of bells and whistles that you can plug in.
Right.
But you're still, what, feeding air in through the bellows to make the sound?
Right, the bellows control the volume.
Can you just open and close the bellows so we just hear them breathe there?
Yep, so.
Yeah. So the bellows makes it more forte, louder or softer.
It's very sensitive, just like a real accordion.
So it's very physical.
Very physical, yes.
Yeah. You go to these international championships. You win in New Zealand. You win the world championship this fall. We have quotes. We read quotes about you where people say in other countries a good jazz player like Pesatoro is king. You know, king in other countries, but here it's just slow. It's just slow catching on. I mean, you come back and you say, hey, I won the world championship. And it's
I know. I couldn't get much media attention from it. I got on a national TV show in New Zealand, actually, while I was there. But I come here, it's like, ah.
You're going to stick with it, though.
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
What would be making it for you?
Making it would be, I guess, if I was on a fame level of, you know, Eminem to Miley Cyrus to Britney Spears and Bruce Springsteen, something like that. And it's like, oh, yeah, Corey Pesadero's coming to town. Yeah, let's go see him.
Well, like you said, he just bought an accordion. He needs a player.
there's a lot of bands. Madonna has one of these Rollins. A lot of bands out there are getting them, so. Yeah.
Well, and Corey Pesatoro is the best at playing it. His two CDs are Change in the Weather and Crosswinds. He has a whole bunch of YouTube postings that we'll link you to at our website, hereandnow.org. Everything's included, including rap.
Rap, Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson. Can I just hear a little Michael Jackson? I know you have to change this.
Yeah, no, hold on. Oh, that's easy because that's this. What I want to do here. Jane or something.
Okay. We'll have those at our website. Meantime, how about something beautiful to go out? Maybe an Astor Piazzolla tango or... Thank you.